Welcome to Emotional Sobriety. Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery. And to my delight, we have Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge in on the stream. And we wanted to discuss the evolution of the concept of emotional sobriety and sort of take stock, seeing as how this is the last episode of 2024, to take stock of, you know, how it's evolved for us personally. And maybe we, in sharing that with you, you know, we can add some insight. So just let's go around first and reintroduce ourselves. How are you guys doing on this near eve of the end of the year?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's a little bit telling that that Patrick, that you're so excited when you have to introduce me and Alan, because it's our fucking podcast. I mean, we should be here. I know. I've dropped out a couple of times without notice, and so yes, you can be very thrilled that the people who are supposed to be here are here. And I'm doing great. I'm ready for. I'm the only thing I want to say at the outset is just, is it just me or is time just rushing by? It's fast. I can feel the wind in my hair, man.
There is that experience is as we get older that the days and years just rush by, and when you're younger, they seem to crawl by.
Well, I had a. I may have said this on here before, but I had a physicist as a client one time, and he explained this to me. And it's one of those things, you know, the kind of people that Daniel Siegel's one of these guys to me too. He's so smart. You can listen to him and everything he says makes so much sense. It's total sense. He can explain this most complex scientific thing to me about the brain. I can get it. I got it. And I come out of the session where I've just heard him speak, and people say, "Well, what did he say?" And I go, I don't know. But here's the thing about this physicist. I remember one thing he explained to me about time and why we experience it faster as we get older, and it's just about ratios. And the simplest example is when we're 4 years old, 1 year is 1/4 of our lives. When you're our age, it's not. It's a very small percentage of our lives. And he said that makes all the difference in how we perceive it.
Great way to understand it.
Well, if I could share briefly about the way I've experienced time, it's been rushing by for me as well. And I think you guys are correct that it is in some sense a function of age, but it must also be presence, the degree of presence, and that it relates somewhat to the, you know, the proverb, a watched pot never boils. But when you're watching it, you know, but now that I'm, you know, kind of cultivating my garden, it's amazing how much, in the effort to, you know, to really manage my life or to be present, show up for my life as fully as I can every single day. I shouldn't say every single day. I've definitely had some off days, but yeah, I mean, I look down and I look up and it's a new year. So it's crazy for me as well.
The philosopher Seneca, the Stoic from many years, thousands of years ago in Rome, he wrote a book called A Little Book on the Shortness of Life. And it's like one of the things that he says that really is a confrontation to us all. He says people, and he's talking about like a couple of thousand years ago, you know, but same thing happened now. He says people complain about life being too short. He says life's not too short if you don't waste it. Basically, he says we waste so much of our time. He says if you use, it's exactly what Patrick's saying. It's like if you show up and if you use your time, like if you choose it and you use it wisely, it's not too short, you know. And I don't think that's true for any. It's too short for all of us because there's not one of us, at least among the three of us, who haven't wasted a shitload of time, you know. And being in recovery has not radically changed that for me. I would say I'm still working on it, but it is a call to arms to basically, and that's a great thing to say at the end of 1 year and beginning of another is let's pay attention. You know, let's among one. That's one of the tenets of good emotional sobriety is showing up, paying attention. Now, some of these things, most of these things are quite simple. It's just not easy.
Well, I think you were also quoting the Stoic. I think that's one of the evolutions that we've seen in our discussions of emotional sobriety is the integration of thought and philosophy from outside of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
And bringing those concepts that really, you know, have a high degree of relevance to what we talk about as emotional sobriety. And Stoicism is one of those things.
Most wisdom, whatever program we find it in, whatever place we discover wisdom, it's the same. You know, the wisdom of Buddhism is the same as the wisdom we talk about, the wisdom of Stoicism. The philosophy of AA is one of the, at least one of my favorite, because it's so familiar to me, but one of my favorite ways to describe it. I mean, it is very philosophical in that sense it basically works if you work it. It's one of the simplest concepts. It's like any of us who, you know, and I'll make one of my themes today, learning how to confront ourselves without beating ourselves up. Because, you know, you and I have talked about this past year, Alan, that sometimes because we focus so much on helping people not be condemning of themselves, I've discovered that people can get to the place where they basically are too protective of themselves and think they're not supposed to criticize themselves. You know, we all need healthy self-criticism. We all need to be able to look at ourselves honestly as adults and make improvements. I mean, otherwise we're not growing. And so I always, you know, I want us to, I'll make a kind of a resolution here for our podcast that I'm going to try to be somebody who reminds people about healthy self-criticism as we go along, because, and I'm the first guy to say it's completely different from self-condemnation. It's like, we just need a new language. We need to understand, make that distinction. Criticism is not condemnation. And we need to be able to criticize each other. We need to be able to criticize ourselves.
Well, our good friend John Amodeo said it very, very eloquently, I thought. He said, he says, blame, self-blame, all it does is marshal up defenses.
No kidding.
To protect yourself, just like you were saying. But he says the difference between blame and taking responsibility is that responsibility creates empowerment.
Yep.
And that's what you're saying. I mean, yeah. when I'm taking responsibility, I'm empowered now to try something different, to grow myself and to differentiate myself and to you know, practice some of these principles of emotional sobriety that we're talking about.
Yeah, my most recent little metaphor in my head is a for God knows what reason, a nautical one, but it is that blame is an anchor and responsibility are sails. You know, the blame will slow us down, at least stop us, but the responsibility is going to take us forward. And to me, I say that with such feeling because you know how this is, guys. Both of you do. It's like the things Richard Bach in his book Illusions used this line. It was wonderful. We teach best what we most need to learn, and it's like so. The things I have the most passion about teaching, you can guarantee, it's something that's been very valuable for me to learn. That there was a time in not too distant past when I didn't know what I'm talking about, what I'm saying now. It's like it's because it's so much. You and I talk about this a lot, Alan. It's one of the reasons that keeps us not burned out in this work. It's like we're fascinated with how we can keep learning, and it's, you know, and that includes self-criticism. Learning, I got to know how I fuck things up in order to keep doing better.
In light of that, because I think we should take stock in this New Year's observation about where we've been and where we're going. One thing I've learned, and we discussed this a little bit in our holiday episodes, is that I still have a lower than I'd like level of differentiation as concerns my family, my parents, and my significant other, because I found myself, I'm in recovery from anger as well. And I found myself over the holiday when things started to like de-align from what my expectations and rules were, that I started to get angry, you know, and I started to raise my voice, and like, you know, these kind of toxic tendencies started to creep back in. And God, like, emotional sobriety is just such a, like, I always come back, and I've mentioned it before, the metaphor, or the visual metaphor of the pottery wheel. You got to just keep massaging that clay, you know, and as soon as you take your hands away from it and you aren't kind of conscious of it and working it, it all starts to get goobered up. And like, I think, you know, I've discovered that about myself, that like, you know, I have a very thin membrane, you know, when I'm trying to make everybody happy and taking it upon myself to kind of like be the, you know, the one who's satisfying everybody's needs in my orbit. You know what I mean? Nobody asked me to do that, but I'm taking it upon myself. And then I'm very brittle in that state and emotionally unsober. And I got to work on that. I mean, I just, because it's not good. I don't like it. It reminds me of the old me that I would very much like to keep in its place when I get so desperate or kind of anxious that I start raising my voice. And it's always with somebody that I really care about, you know, that I don't want to be relating to in that way. And then I've got to come back around and apologize. And that's where I'm at. That's the project, one of the projects for next year's emotional sobriety.
And that's what it is kind of seeing ourselves without judgment is such a difficult thing. Doesn't mean not pulling ourselves up and say, look, I want to do better here. There's a lot of room for that. There's a lot of room for saying, hey, I'd really like to give more effort in this area. I want to understand how come I keep resisting this. Those things are very, very helpful to our growth. But like you said, Tom, putting ourselves down, it drops an anchor.
That's a leak. It's leaking massive energy, man. We're wasting energy when we do that.
It's like having a rowboat. You start to row away from the pier, but you forget to untie yourself. And you keep rowing and you keep rowing. And you're not going anywhere, man. You're just not going anywhere.
I love that.
I'm going to put on all this effort. I'm giving all this effort to get it somewhere, and I'm stuck.
When we're feeling slowed down or stuck, that's what give people progress, not perfection. Give yourself credit for what you've learned, and just the fact that if I'm still tied to the pier today, if I at least look up and know, oh, I need to look there. Give myself, not rather than beat myself up for being tired of the pier once more, give myself credit for knowing this sooner to look. Because it gets me, I'm more efficient.
I think that's the other thing that we've really focused on this last year in terms of the evolution of this concept of emotional sobriety is to really capture the process behind what Bill was talking about. Bill defined it and he gave us a few clues about where to start looking and what to do. But I think one of the things that we've done, you know, well, and we'll continue to do, and I'm quite confident in that, is to really look, you know, somebody described my work as picking up the rock and looking at all of those little insects that live underneath it, right? Those little roly-polies, you know what a roly-poly is? You know, those little things?
The most adorable of the insects.
And that's what I think we've been doing is mining in a very good way this whole concept. And part of it is what, you know, we're talking about now, Tom, is relating it to this larger set of wisdom, right, that exists in this world. There is so much wisdom around that we can tap into. And that's what really emotional sobriety, if you boil it down to, it's a practice of living wisely. And living wisely creates emotional freedom. And freedom, you know, the other thing that really came, and I think this happened in our last Thursday night when we were talking, Tom, is we talk so much about the individual here, right? And differentiation and differentiating yourself. But as I mentioned last week, there's also the need for that community to be able to turn to support, and that we can't always just give ourselves a support. It's learning how to ask for help, and sometimes just making ourselves vulnerable and open enough where people just out of their love and concern reach out to help us.
Yeah. This reminds me very much of something I experienced around in the 1990s when we were, when we had been very heavy duty into inner child work specifically. And it became, aware to me, I was with working with a friend of mine, and we got into this discussion, you know, where it became like what Al Franken used to call me, call the me generation. You know, there was lots and lots of work, but it got to feel really selfish to me. It was like, we're all just going to take care of our own little child, and we're going to have boundaries with our parents, and we're going to have boundaries with this stuff. But no, then I started to think about, what are we doing all this for? Now this is going to make sound like a little, I'm off on a tangent, but it's like, we're doing it to plug back in to the rest of the world, to the community. And it's like that's talk about purpose. There's where you have the purpose. And I think that this takes us that way.
Well, it's learning how to have healthy relationships, right? It's really, if you boil it down to what we're talking about, is all of this work we're doing is, like you said, to get to be able to connect in a way that is good for us and good for the person we're connecting to. You know, it's that idea of acting for ourselves without ourselves.
One of the things that I've been working on very, very focused and very specific for the last few months is getting back to really learning things about connecting to the greater wisdom, that my inner wisdom, the wisdom beyond me, and I'm not being religious. I'm just saying the wisdom of the of bigger universe. There's, you know, powers greater than me. And it's like, I think I'd gotten away from that a lot and just gone back into almost a little bit more of a survival mode. And it's like, I think there's a lot of things we can do. And I'm speaking to myself when I say that, to just remind ourselves to stop, slow down, ask questions and listen for the answer. I do this with my clients sometimes, and sometimes I forget, is a client's presenting something that's really a dilemma for them. Before I decide to tell them all the brilliant things I'm thinking, you know, take a minute, just stop for a minute, ask yourself that question and just sit quietly and let's see what comes up. It's like, they're going to do better than I am because it's them they're talking about. And if I can be wise enough to stop and remind them to ask for inner wisdom.
Yeah, Fritz Perls called it an organismic wisdom.
Yes.
That our bodies just have a body of knowledge. I mean, look at, how is it that we regulate our temperature and heart rate all day long without thinking about it? I mean, that's pretty clever.
Pretty clever.
Right? That becomes an automatic question. We don't have to think about it, so we can do other things. I mean, the economy that we are designed with is just phenomenal. You know, it really is. It's incredible that we maximize our functioning. This is what Goldstein said. He says, we have a tendency to actualize what is possible. And it's so true, man. I just see that resonates, that echoes to me to all levels of behavior, relationships, you know, personally, intrapsychically, all levels of understanding. You know, I think the other thing that was coming to mind as we were talking about that I've been aware of this last year is just the important role of empathy in terms of creating safety.
Yes.
Is that without empathy, it's very difficult to feel safe in a relationship with someone else.
Yeah.
It is very difficult. And listen, you know what I've gone through the last couple of years with that, and I realize is that's not just empathy towards the other person, but it's empathy towards self as well.
Mm-hmm.
That if I don't listen to what my experience is and pay attention to it, that's where empathy in many ways starts, is in terms of am I respecting, and it's funny, respect and respond, they begin with the first, mm-hmm. the first three, four letters are mm-hmm. the same, right? R-E-S-P, right?
Mm-hmm.
Respect and respond and respond. All of that, you know, am I able to respect and respond appropriately to what I'm experiencing? And see, this is where all those rules about how we should be interfere with healthy functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I'm paying attention to should, I'm not paying attention to me. Yeah. I mean, that's the bottom line, man. I'm getting lost in these ideas that I have. I'll never forget what Dr. Kempler said one time. He says, love cannot be a plan nor a commitment. And I had to really stop and think about, what does that mean? He says, love can't be a plan or a commitment. It has to be a result of who we are with each other.
Yeah, more process focused, not result focused.
We have to define that in terms of what our relationship is and what I need and what you need and how we manage our respective needs in that relationship.
Well, I don't know if this is a Alan Berger original or if you were quoting somebody else, but when you told me that relationships are people growers, you know, and kind of laid that in the context of emotional sobriety. And from the very beginning of when you and I would sit down, and whenever there'd be a question, should I go towards this relationship? And I'm not just referring to romantic relationship, just like a collaboration in all forms with different people. There's just no question. Absolutely. Go towards that. And, you know, that is distinct from what differentiation is. I think my cast of characters has expanded so much year after year, to the point where it's become a little exhausting. Like the last few days I've been dog sitting for a couple dogs, and it's kind of that nook in between Christmas and New Year's, where for the first time in months, probably, I felt like I have permission to just like not get on the phone and to just like stare at the TV and just do some pretty like useless things, because so much of my year has been occupied by usefulness. I need to do more usefulness. It's going to be exhausting at times, but I think that the emotional sobriety project will involve going towards like those relationships with people and making myself available to that cast of characters and kind of seeing where it takes me. Because yeah, as we've said time and time again, you know, it's like the inverse of that was true of my addictive state, you know, my sick kind of earlier self, you know, was very withdrawn and uninvolved. And, you know, I think emotional sobriety is the opening up.
Well, let me say two things to that. And one is, I volunteer to be, if you need a mentor for uselessness, by the way, I will help you with that. I've got lots and lots of experience with it. And, but the other thing, I want to go back to what when you were quoting Alan about relationships being people growers, is it reminds me of I say it humorously, but it's got meaning to it, which is, as I tell people, you know, the reason I believe in God is because of relationships. Because if you look at our relationships, we look at the people we're with, somebody's fucking with us. You know, this is no accident. You know, somebody somewhere, God said, let's put Tom and Dee Dee together. And the other guys around said, no, man, don't do it. He goes, no, watch, this will be funny. And so I just, you know, that's one of my little nutshells is, God has a sense of humor. It's just not a very good one. But it's like,
as Don Rickles.
But working with, Alan knows this, working with relationships, you go like, these aren't accidents. You know, we look at our own relationships, but the thing is, it really takes us to what I learned most from Harville Hendrix, which is, you know, rather than seeing our pairing with people that push our buttons as a pathology, to see it as a assistance, a help, that we are drawn to people who can help us grow, that are going to challenge us where we need to be challenged. And that reframe is a very powerful one, and can really, first of all, it can help you continue to have compassion for your partner when you need more compassion for your partner rather than less. And it's because you're there to help each other.
I think the other thing that kind of been foreground for me is now this accepting what is and dealing with what is. It seems like you said, Tom, such a simple concept, but it's not easy at all. Like, I've gone through, you know, as you have, a lot of physical challenges with the peripheral neuropathy from Agent Orange, the surgery I had, and then the subsequent fracture and PT, and then recently the surgery I had to deal with some of the severe arthritis in my left big toe. And I realize that there's a part of me that keeps saying, well, I want to get back to what I was. But guess what? That's a fantasy, man.
That's going backwards. You're not it's going backwards. Wow. That's right.
I can't go backwards, man. I can't. I want to. I'd love to be pain-free. I'd love to wake up and not have to manage pain all day long. But that's not my life right now. Now right. My life is managing my pain
right.
and doing the best I can.
Right yeah, now, yeah, you might as well want to be 40 off. Again, right? You might as well say, I wish I was 40 again. Okay, well, that's a nice wish. We understand it. Can we get on back to reality?
And it's been an experiment, man. I've you know, been on different medications, GABA, and pregabalin, and all kinds of stuff. And I just, none of it's working for me. I'm pretty much, I haven't used an opioid in quite some time now. But, you know, I'm living on about 1,200 milligrams of Advil a day.
Yeah.
And right now, that's, to me, a lot better, even though there's a lot of risk with that. It's a lot better than the cognitive impairment I was experiencing on the Lyrica that I was on recently.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting. The other part of it is it's all a big experiment, man. It's a big experiment. Finding that path and trying this on and seeing if it fits and if it works and then being able to let it go. I think that's the other thing, is that emotional sobriety is really a movement away from rigidity.
Yes.
Right? It's really
yes.
towards flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
I am to be able to, you know, and like you said, Tom, we can't find that flexibility if I'm beating myself up. That's rigidity.
Right.
That's a rule absolutely. That I have that I wait and all of that. But that whole idea that I can be okay even if is, you know, introducing an awful lot of flexibility in our life. I was realizing the other day is that there's a group of people in AA that are called the No Matter What Club. No matter what, they don't drink.
That's good.
But I would say that's a subset of emotional sobriety.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
It's emotional sobriety takes it to the next level that says I'm okay even if I have all of these challenges and difficulties that I'm dealing with now. If I have faith of being able to stay in the process, that something is going to reveal itself that's going to help me find my way.
What you're describing, Alan, you know, that wisdom, what it becomes for me is when I'm not feeling it, and often, you know, when I'm going through crisis, I don't feel it inside, you know what I mean? I feel very guided by in my environmental circumstances. I tell myself that story and I keep telling myself that story, knowing that it's true and then hoping that the bridge will be created in myself between what my inner experience is and, you know, what's happening. And then eventually it does. And I mean, I think with your pain, Alan, right, that is something you're working as well, right? Which is that, like, your pain's screaming at you. It's telling you, you know what I mean? Like, you know, this is what's guiding me. This is my life. This is where I'm kind of, this is where my lodestar is, right? But the process of emotional sobriety is the extricating yourself from that.
It's kind of going beyond it, isn't it? Like you said, yeah. It's extricating yourself. And at the same time, you know, what you said, Tom, before about the awareness and using the awareness of what I'm doing
mm-hmm.
and being honest with ourselves in terms of what I'm doing and how I'm contributing to my existence becomes such an important, you know, part of that equation in yeah. terms of getting to an experience of emotional sobriety and freedom.
Well, it's such a,
the other thing I've learned, Tom, I think, I was just going to say, I think the other thing that's evolved is we've gotten a lot of feedback that this stuff has been very meaningful for a lot of people
mm-hmm.
from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this. And, you know, I think part of it is how darn consistent we are with the message. I mean,
yeah.
You know, we keep showing.
We're quite redundant.
Almost, what, 5 years now.
Yes, I like it.
Well, I think, I'll tell you, we're not, though. I don't think so. See, I really think we are redundant in terms of the emotional sobriety message. But I'll tell you, the thing I really love about working with you and Herb and Roger when he was here, how we keep bringing in new concepts and ideas all the time.
Yeah, you're right.
Like when you brought in that idea, that was one of the epiphanies this last year for me. Excuse me. When you came up with the idea that not only do we say I'd be okay if we also have the idea I'd be okay if this didn't happen to me.
Yeah.
When you brought in the other side of that equation, I thought that really opened up a whole dimension of that consciousness that we hadn't really explored enough.
Well, so much of this is about, I mean, this simple, you know, we can always get these little simple things, but they're very powerful. One is you can't solve a problem that you have not accurately identified. And it's like, and that's what you're talking about when you're talking about waking up every day and dealing with the problems as you experience them in your life right now. It's like there's all kinds of things we could do. If we were writing fiction, we could come up with characters that have different problems and we could solve those. But each of us has corny metaphor, but we're dealt the cards we're dealt, and we can't change that. We can only change how good of card players we become. And you're becoming a good card player with with a pretty bad hand some days in terms of your physical stuff that you're dealing with. And it's like, and that's not to say, oh, poor you. It's just to say, no, that's a challenge. You have to get to be a better card player.
Hearing from different listeners who are in pursuit of emotional sobriety, who don't have alcoholism or drugs as necessarily their first foray into this world. Like, I find that very inspiring, you know, and that tells me that that the alcohol and the drugs are just an expression of something deeper, you know, which emotional sobriety is, you know, trying to get its hands around. I mean, that's just like as good as it gets for me. So I love hearing from, anybody who's up against this.
My first sponsor, I don't know if it's original to him. He's the first guy I ever heard it from. Probably other people have said it throughout AA, but early on, he said, we were looking at the steps. He said, there's 12 steps of recovery. And this next sentence, he said it very precisely. He said, the first one mentions alcohol. He didn't even say the first one's about alcohol. He just said the first of 12 steps mentions it. And it's like that stuck with me and has grown with me throughout the thing, because I love the idea. And I think I probably said that on the here before, that I used to earlier in my recovery, I used to think, what do people do who aren't drunks and addicts? You know, how do they get help? How do they get well? Because, you know, now that was a very narrow-minded view I had as a recovering addict. But it's like my question was legitimately like how do other people have access to this information? And, you know, and of course it goes to what we were saying earlier. There's all kinds of avenues for this kind of wisdom throughout the world. But that's what emotional sobriety is more than anything to me. It's the version of this that is open to everyone. There's no, you know, I love it when Alan begins our Thursday meeting. You know, the only requirement for being membership here is to want to be here. That's the whole thing. That's all there is ever. If you want to be talking about the shit we're talking about, come on, let's go. We really love hearing from you, and you can't do that too much. I mean, to any one of the three of us, when we hear from you guys, that inspires conversation between us, among us, and so please do, if you're thinking of something or if you're touched by something we're talking about, please let us know. It really makes a difference to us.
I'm embroiled very much in just trying to figure out what my career is going to be. And that is still an open question. I've got a few irons in the fire, but I'll be working on that next year, but kind of somewhat connected to that, but in a way more important and in kind of more aligned with my purpose is, the next, Friendly Circle Berlin, international conference. The first one was in London earlier this year. The next year is going to be in Dublin. And it looks like I'm going to be involved in streaming and kind of creating a virtual component of the conference so that people in the States, you know, who can't visit in person can kind of attend emotional sobriety, kind of like groups and seminars and things like that. And Alan, of course, is going to be involved, you know, doing like the live portion of the event. But I love this opportunity to be able to do some of the stuff that we do in the podcast, but kind of broaden it even more and kind of like bring more people in. And, I've never done, you know, on a technical level, I've never attempted something like this, you know, and so I'm hoping it's going to grow me in more ways than one. And it'll be a continuation of kind of like what we do on here every week, hopefully bring a lot more people into the fold with all the stuff we're talking about.
Well, congratulations and kudos for you. Just the courage it takes to stretch out there and do that. That's you don't get better and you don't get what you're looking for without taking risk. And that's beautiful. And you'll do great.
If I fall on my face. Yeah. don't laugh too much.
If you fall on your face, we're not going to be. We'll be right here. We're not going anywhere.
Oh, we'll be there to pick you up.
That's right. We'll be there to pick you up. Alan he's already about to fall down anyway. He'll throw himself under you to break your fall. It's like
nice.
We're not gonna let you fall very far, buddy.
I think that's the other thing we can feel good about, Tom.
What's that?
Is that we've had a small part in bringing Bill's wish that this would be spearhead the next major development in recovery. And I think that we're doing that.
I think so. And I'm glad to include myself in that. That's very nice and sweet for you, but I also, I'm not trying to deflect that. I'm just saying to you, you're a big piece. I told you, you were born about the time Bill Wilson was wrapping up his life. It's like, somewhere you guys, it's like a relay race. Some guys, he passed that baton onto you that way as in your infancy, as you were coming into this world and you grew up and early on you got recovery early and you began this process early. And it's like, no, I see that as definitely the relay between you and Bill Wilson. And I love being a part of it.
Let's keep the party going.
Party going, you guys. Happy New Year to you guys.
Happy New Year.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.